This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. All the great stuff that we've been doing Sunday, October the 25th. That includes Richard Dean waking up before 4 a.m. to have a chat with CNN anchor and now author Fareed Zakari about a new book he's written about how to thrive in a post-pandemic world. We've also had a look at what might happen to the new James Bond movie. Is it the latest streaming acquisition? We've been talking about a potential change to the bankruptcy laws here in the UAE. That's with Abdullah Matawi of Al-Tamimi & Co. And of course, Serena has been in with all your latest COVID news and numbers.
Ask Serena.
With Fragoman, dedicated exclusively to immigration services worldwide.
Questions coming in thick and fast, Serena. We'll get to camping rules and regulations shortly, but first of all, give us an update on the number of cases overnight.
So this time last week, we were talking about 1,538 new cases. Yesterday, they announced 1,491 new cases. So that's after more than 124,400 tests were conducted across the UAE. So out of the 123,764 reported cases in the Emirates, breaking the figure down for you as always, we've got 6,395 people being treated currently for COVID-19 in the UAE. 475 fatalities, because there was none reported in the past 24 hours, and 116,894 recoveries. And just looking internationally, as a globe, as the world, more than 42.9 million reported cases, out of which more than 10.1 million are active. Fatalities, more than 1.1 million. Recovered, more than 31.6 million.
You've been looking at the inspections and some of the fines that are happening. But also, we must point out the hundreds and hundreds of organisations that are complying with the rules and regulations.
Yeah, and it seems that figure seems to be going up quite a lot, which is obviously very reassuring.
The number that are complying is going
exactly,
up.
Exactly, yes. So in the latest round of inspections, 147 shops and commercial establishments were found to have been fully compliant with the precautionary measures when it comes to COVID-19. Three commercial establishments, a textile outlet and a supermarket, they were fined in Dubai for violating COVID-19 social physical distancing rules. So the outlets located in Al Hamriya and Sakat Al Khail. But what Dubai Economy is just saying is, like, please, if you come across any areas, establishments, venues, you find that they're not really implementing those safety protocols, do get in touch. You can use the Dubai Consumer app, their website, consumerrights.ae, and they're welcoming the feedback so they can go and investigate, inspect, and make sure that everybody's following the rules that are in place.
Now, great excitement for Brandy Scott this morning, personally and professionally, because Global Village is back.
It opens today for its Silver Jubilee season from 4 o'clock this afternoon, I believe. So organisers have issued a set of precautionary health and safety guidelines for visitors. I know you've been talking with them as well and got a lot of information on that. But guests, just, you know, FYI, a few points that you need to remember. Wear face masks at all times. Complimentary face masks will be handed out to children. 2 metre physical distance must be maintained. Anyone experiencing symptoms like coughing, fever, really should avoid going to the park. Elderly guests and people with chronic conditions, they're advised to avoid crowded areas there. Thermal cameras have been installed at all entry points to check for temperature of staff and visitors. So you've got everything is up to protocol, up to standard. You've got more than 600 hand sanitizers have been installed around the park. But just everything from contactless payment solutions, that's something to keep in mind when you are heading down. All common areas and touch points will be frequently sterilized during working hours. And of course, when it closes, they'll make sure the entire park is completely disinfected as well.
Brandy, you've been speaking to Bada Anwahi, the boss. I've got his sound bites here. Let's have a blast of Bada. Which one would you want to go for?
Oh, let's start with what everyone is wondering about, which is safety procedures.
The moment you enter Global Village, there is a thermal screening camera that will ensure that everybody who enters the park are being checked from temperature point of view, and there are protocols in place to make sure that the park is safe. For sure, all guests must wear their mask all time, except the dining at the restaurant and where the social distancing is applied between the tables in the restaurant. Carnival ride will be operating at reduced capacity and will be sanitized after every use. Prayer rooms will also be sanitized after every prayer, and there will be no group prayers. We have reduced the capacity of the existing prayer rooms and introduced new rooms as well. We have increased the frequency of cleaning across the park, including full disinfection every night after closure.
And there's a lot more to it than that, including fiberglass teddy bears being used as social distancing markers for children to make sure that they can't get too close to each other.
Should we hear Badr on the fiberglass teddy bears?
Yeah, I like
it. He tells it well.
When it comes to the entertainment, we have also re-looked into the show's frequencies and durations. By the main stage, for the first time, we have limited the capacity to 30%, where there will be benches and families, they can sit together and enjoy it while keeping enough distance. Now, Global Village is an outdoor venue, which is an advantage to ensure that we have proper distancing and safety in place. We came up also with some creative ideas when it comes to the kids' theater, for example. What we did is basically we have placed fiberglass teddy bear, which basically sits and takes a position in the bench of the kids' theater, which ensures that there are distancing between the kids who are watching and enjoying the show.
I don't know about your kids, Serena, but I hope those fiberglass teddy bears are screwed down, because mine would just have them. Thanks very much.
I was just thinking that. I was like, oh, what's this doing in the Kelly household? We need to go back to Global Village and return it.
So it's that way. Serena, thank you very much indeed.
More details on the Air and News Centre app.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Well, we are now going to dig into one of the big reported stories of last week, a suggestion that the UAE is amending its bankruptcy law to deal with emergencies, such as pandemics. But what's actually being done? What do we know? And what are we still waiting to find out? We are speaking now to Abdullah Matawi. He's head of corporate commercial and a partner at the law firm Al Tamimi & Co. Abdullah, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Morning, Bradley. Thanks for having me on.
What's the situation here, Abdullah?
So there was a story reported in the press last Wednesday. It's been very widely reported in the press, although we haven't seen anything official yet, but what was reported is that there's a ministerial decision to make some amendments to the existing bankruptcy law, the 2016 bankruptcy law. And from what we can tell from the news stories, the amendments appear to be introducing some kind of concept of emergency situations. It has to be said that hasn't, as far as we can tell, been defined, although some of the press reports are saying this extends specifically to companies affected negatively by the pandemic. And what we have to yet, what remains to be seen is whether that is kind of explicit in the changes or whether that's going to be down to the courts to interpret. But generally, the idea is that these amendments are going to provide some kind of relief to companies that have been negatively affected by emergency situations, which could include the pandemic. And the key provisions that are being reported are providing a grace period of not more than 12 months that would allow companies time to talk to their creditors and reach some kind of a settlement with them before they are then forced into applying for a bankruptcy under the bankruptcy law.
Okay, so you're being very careful here, and I would expect nothing less. You're a lawyer, that's what people pay you for. But when you say, as far as we can tell, is this normal? Is this the usual way of finding out about changes to a law? What would you expect to happen?
Yeah, no, it's a good point. Look, I mean, the stories like this do hit the press before the cabinet announcements and legislative changes actually become formally into law by publication in the Gazette. So in the past, you know, we have seen sometimes press reports that say something is about to happen and it's really big. In this particular case, what we're not sure about is what is actually going to change to the law as it currently stands. So the bankruptcy law as it exists and was brought into force in 2016 already has several provisions in it that allow companies options to come to the UAE court to apply for protection while they try and rearrange debt or restructure debt with their creditors. And there are a couple of different processes that are already there. So what's not clear from this from these reports is exactly what in the law is to change. And I think that's why we're being careful, because we want to see exactly what is being changed, because a lot of the stuff that's being reported sounds quite similar to what's already in the law.
Right. What difference would a as you say, a longer period there, a longer turnaround period, a longer period of time to sort things out make at the moment?
Well, look, I mean, there's no doubt that the pandemic has obviously had an impact on a lot of businesses, and much more than you would typically expect. And of course, this is a global phenomenon. So I guess what's happening across economies all over the world, including the UAE, is that, you know, people that are running businesses that rely on generating cash to service debt have been really suffering over a prolonged period of time. And of course, suppliers, business suppliers and banks that are lending money to businesses are having to wait longer and longer for repayment. So I guess, you know, the introduction concept like emergency situations, possibly including impact on companies from a pandemic, would, I guess, just provide a little bit of relaxation. But, it, you know, that can have a positive impact on businesses, but it can also have a, you know, the flip side is a potentially negative impact on creditors, because, of course, you know, they are also businesses, whether they're lending banks or whether they're trade creditors and suppliers. So, again, you know, let's wait and see what the changes actually say. But I guess the point I really wanted to focus on is that, as I say, at the moment, you can, if you are in financial difficulty but not yet insolvent, or if you've been sort of technically insolvent for a period of less than 30 days, as a company, as a debtor, you can go to the court and ask for a preventative composition order that would appoint a trustee and give you a period to renegotiate your debts. And so that's already there. And I think, you know, we're all interested to see here is whether these new reported changes extend the period that is already provided for under the law, which is fairly generous.
We've got just 1 minute with you, Abdullah. Are we seeing this law, or do you expect to see this law tested more, the bankruptcy laws?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, look, the other thing that's available for creditors as well as companies that are in debt is a restructuring process under the bankruptcy law. I mean, what we as lawyers are sort of advising clients in financial difficulty is engage with your creditors as early as you possibly can to avoid ending up being tested in the courts, because the problem with heavily court supervised processes is that they can actually have a really negative long-term impact. Yes, it is. I'm sure it will be more tested just because of the general situation. But our advice to clients always is, if you see difficulty coming, engage with your creditors. Try and get to a voluntary arrangement with your creditors before you have to go to court, before you have to take advantage of the provisions under the law. Because once the law gets involved, or once you get the law involved, then you're very much at the hands of the court. And that can actually be quite a negative thing, just because of the amount of time and delay that can be caused by that.
Abdullah Matawi, partner and head of corporate commercial at Altamimi & Company, talking us through what we do know, what we don't know, what we're waiting to know, and what we might know about potential amendments to the UAE's bankruptcy laws.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Well, staying with markets and economics, Brandy, one of the stories we've had out over the past 24 hours is the economic stimulus here in Dubai. It was announced by the Crown Prince, His Highness Sheikh Hamdan. It's going to come in the form of rebates in terms of fees and charges and license fees, but also in some cases rents as well. The one that both you and I picked up on was nurseries, as in early years education, and some of the focus on those guys.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this adds to the current stimulus at the moment. This is 500 million dirhams worth of things you don't have to pay for, basically. Brings the total to 6.8 billion is what's been put into the economy so far. And as you say, nurseries is a biggie, and Sheikh Hamdan's made quite a big deal of it as well, because we know that nurseries were shut a lot longer than a lot of other establishments, weren't they? Which causes a problem not just for parents, but for the people who work in them. So they are exempt from, for example, renewal fees of their commercial licences, extending the licences. Health professionals who work in nurseries will see their licences extended for another 6 months after they expire. If you are in a knowledge fund establishment, location. You get a 50% reduction in rent until the end of the year. Other sectors as well that we know have been hard hit, things like tourism, basically events, entertainment, where we have seen things shut down, and some people obviously feeling that. There's going to be a freeze on fees for various ticket sales, for permits that are issued, to try and make it a little bit easier. Retail sector is another one. The freeze on government permit fees for the retail sector is also going to be extended.
Let's get the thoughts now of Ed Bell. He is Senior Director of Market Economics for Emirates NBD. His take on the new Dubai stimulus.
The government of Dubai has announced another 500 million dirhams worth of aid for businesses in the emirate, taking total assistance up to almost 7 billion dirhams. Most of this aid is going to be in the form of exemption from fees or lower rents, helping firms that are still afloat lower their overheads. However, the new package does not appear to entail any additional spending to add to the economy that would allow consumption and investment to recover. The signs we've seen over the summer months is from the Dubai Economy Tracker, a PMI for the emirate, has been showing that the economy has been hovering at the low 50 range, indicating that Dubai's economy is essentially stabilizing, albeit at a likely lower overall level of output.
That's the voice of Ed Bell of Emirates NBD. Brandy, we might have a new business model for this guy.
And I've got a Global Village tie-in as well.
James Bond Global Village.
It's the 25th James Bond.
Oh, she's good.
There you go. But this Bond film, No Time to Die, has pretty much been... I mean, a lot of cinema chains are holding it up.
It's had a lot of time to die, hasn't it?
No time to air. Exactly. And that's been the problem. Cinemas have been waiting for a big film to get people in. And James Bond, it seems, is not going to be it. It's been postponed not once, but twice. And it has become a bit of a problem for global cinema chains. Now, the big rumour doing the rounds on the internet... that has been come from a very influential film critic called Drew McWeeny, is that it might not go to cinemas at all. It might go the way of the big Disney, Mulan, was it? The big
Mulan,
Disney release,
yeah.
And go straight to streaming. And the question this morning is whether or not it would find its home on Apple TV or whether it would find a home on Netflix. Drew McWeeny says that the numbers that he is hearing, as in how much said platforms would pay for James Bond, are, and I quote in capital letters, insane.
So at the box office, a Bond film would normally do a few hundred million, mm-hmm. wouldn't it? They cost a couple of hundred million to make. Mm-hmm. They normally do 3, 4, maybe 5 on a good outing, 500 million at the box office. I mean, Is Netflix going to pay that much?
No.
They can't.
No. No. And that's why I think the model is a head-scratching scenario for movie executives at the moment, is because how do you recoup the amount that you're spending on films? Is that something that needs to be addressed? Because without the big box office launch, you just ain't going to make that money back. If people are downloading and streaming.
Yeah, and this made me wonder as well. Apparently there's quite a bit of pressure on MGM, the people behind the film, to sell it. Drew McWeeny says that there are monster offers, again, capital letters, on the table. But given the amount, I mean, are people going to go and subscribe to an Apple TV or a Netflix just because the James Bond film is coming there? I mean, Disney Plus, I think, had a price on top of the subscription plan for
Mulan. So it's like a
pay-per-view,
almost a premium.
$30, I think, on top of your subscription plan. So is it a case that either platform would say, all right, if you want to see the new James Bond, you'll pay for it? James Bond also is one of those things that strikes me as being a very cinema film. Things go bang,
yeah,
don't they?
Yeah.
You quite like that on a big screen.
Yeah. No, I think
I'm just going to correct my numbers then. I said 300-400 million. The last one, Spectre, did 900 million at the box office. Skyfall did 1.1 billion just at the box office.
Mm. Yeah, it's extraordinary.
Never mind the merch.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're just not going to recoup that. You're not going to get that via one of the platforms at the moment. But then we're looking, it's this rock and the hard place scenario at the present, isn't it? Is I mean, will there be a cinema open when said James Bond film is ready to go to it at the moment. That's the issue for them, and getting the numbers of bums on seats that you're talking about to create those billions over time. We certainly haven't seen it from the movies that have come out, have we? Tenet was meant to be one of the sort of big success stories. Yeah, it's done okay, but nothing near that.
Left everyone a bit confused, didn't it?
Left everyone very confused and walking out going, wow, if that's what you're going to offer us is to try and entice us back into the cinema, what's next? We're seeing it go on and on. Fast and Furious coming out. You know, Fast and Furious. How many times do we joke about Fast and Furious and the numerous films that they've been producing and making over the years? They announced last week that they are doing away with the franchise. The franchise is coming to a close. They're going to make two more. They're going to go to Fast and Furious 11. Still waiting to release Fast and Furious 9, waiting for the right time to do that same thing as the James Bond thing. They're going to do two more and then they're done because they just don't see it as a money-making model. They are going to do their spin-off things, their Hobbs and Shaw thing or whatever they're called or whatever. There will be those spin-off elements. But, you know, that has been a money-making enterprise since the early 2000s.
If you look at the top 10 movie franchises of all time, it's certainly top 10. It's around about 7th or 8th, along with Jurassic World. I mean, it's not Marvel Cinematic Universe or Star Wars, but it's definitely top 10.
Well, here's maybe, well, not really an indication, but Coming to America is a comedy film based on the original Eddie Murphy film, but sort of revamped.
Oh, you can't remake that.
They already have.
Oh.
And it's been sold for, where's the numbers here, $120 million, more than $120 million is what it's expected to have been sold by, and it will be released by Amazon, so on the Amazon platform. So Eddie Murphy,
pay-per-view, do we know,
spin-off, or? Don't know. James Bond, presumably James Bond would go for an awful lot more than that, but there's your benchmark.
You've got me thinking there. What was the name of the hair product in Coming to America? Can you remember?
Well, partly the reason you can't make it again, it's a classic and you shouldn't touch it. But a lot of the jokes probably wouldn't pass muster, would they? There's a lot of stereotyping in there.
It's very true,
you
yeah.
couldn't get away with now.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a big challenge for any re-releases at the moment, isn't it? Or remakes.
Rebecca's got slated, hasn't it?
I started watching some of it last night. Nice clothes.
Right. We're going to talk about this guy.
Today, I want to say, it was my last fight. And no way I'm going to come here without my father. It was first time when, after what happened with my father.
That was Khabib Nurmagomedov talking in Abu Dhabi a few hours ago after winning his fight in the Octagon on Fight Island. This is UFC, mixed martial arts. He's announced his retirement from fighting. Why is that, Tom? Just tell us the story.
His dad died in July as a result of complications related to COVID-19. His dad has been his mentor, his coach, his greatest ally, best friend throughout his entire life. This is his first fight without his dad. He basically said he wouldn't fight. He went to his mum straight after. Apparently they talked about for about 3 days after his dad's death, said, "Mum, I don't want to fight without dad." And she went, "I don't want you to fight. I want you to stop." He went away, had a little think about it. And then his reason being that he needed to dedicate one final fight to his dad's legacy. So this was it. He was convinced by Dana White and the rest of UFC to come back to fight Justin Gaethje yesterday or earlier on this morning in Abu Dhabi. Did exactly that. Won convincingly in the second round and then took the opportunity straight afterwards to say, "I ain't doing this anymore. I've made a promise to my mum. I'm going to keep that promise with my mum. I'm not fighting anymore. I'm bowing out."
Okay, so no more UFC fights. However, my question to you is this. Earlier on this year, you will know that talks were taking place between Khabib's team and Floyd Mayweather's team to have a cross-code fight. $100 million was going to be the guaranteed purse for Khabib. It was going to happen in Saudi Arabia. He said the reason it didn't go ahead is Khabib said, "Well, I've got a contract with UFC. I'm not going to break that contract by fighting in a boxing match." Now he's retired. Does that make the $100 million fight with Floyd in Saudi Arabia, boxing rules, Queensbury rules, more likely?
So two elements to this. Good question, because I was thinking about that overnight. One of the first people to tweet after the Khabib victory and, of course, retirement was, said Conor McGregor, who tweeted this, said, good performance at Team Khabib. I will carry on. It's like, okay, Conor, can I give the guy a little bit of praise? He's just retired with an unblemished record. The second line you put in there is, I will carry on. So he's obviously saying, look, okay, whatever he wants to do, I'm going to still carry on. Khabib seems to be a man of his word and honour. But look, this is boxing. This is mixed martial arts. This is pugilism in all its forms. What does retirement mean in these different fields? You know, an octagon to a ring, from a world championship fight to an exhibition fight. It's watch this space. But I think it's fair to say he's done in UFC with an asterisk alongside that, maybe.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Right, let's get to our interview with Fareed Zakaria, the broadcaster and author. Fareed, as I mentioned earlier, born and raised in Mumbai, moved to the United States as a late teenager to go to Harvard, where he studied international relations, and then got a PhD in international relations. He was editor of Foreign Policy and Newsweek at the age of about 12 or something. Super smart guy. And he's been with CNN for well over a decade now, where he hosts the show GPS. But true to his international relations roots, he's a prolific author about that subject, and his new book is 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World. I caught up with him a couple of days ago from his home in Atlanta in the United States to talk about the book. And the first question I asked him is about the title, 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World. How do you know? Because we're not in a post-pandemic world, much as we'd like to be. We're very much in a pandemic world, and this is what Fareed told me.
I think the most important way to think about this is we are past the threshold of understanding that we live in a new age. In other words, we've gotten to the point where the pandemic is the wake-up call. We are now past that. We understand we are living in an age where we are experiencing a whole series of natural shocks. The pandemic is actually just one of them. We're seeing forest fires in the United States that have consumed 5 million acres. That is, imagine the entire state of Massachusetts in flames. That is how much land has been burned in the West. Look at the hurricanes, the droughts. Look at the temperatures, as you know, not so far from Dubai. You are having a situation where you have 100 degree Fahrenheit temperature is becoming the norm week after week. So we are in a new age, I would argue, an age in which we are beginning to realize that the way we're living is producing a kind of natural backlash. You know, in a sense, we've been living somewhat thoughtlessly, somewhat recklessly, doing things that made more likely things like pandemics, forest fires, droughts, and hurricanes. And now nature is fighting back. And COVID-19 may be the wake-up call we all needed.
So one of the things that you look at, there are many things, is, for example, farming and how we produce food, in particular meat. What's the problem and what is potentially a solution?
So if you think about pandemics happen because we are creating conditions in which these viruses that normally live in animals, 75% of all the diseases that come that humans get start in animals. And what happens is that these viruses jump from animals to humans when they get very strong. Factory farming is a kind of petri dish for this to happen. This is almost certainly going to be the next great pandemic. You crowd thousands and thousands of animals together, cows, chickens, in terribly unsanitary conditions. And then these viruses hop from chicken to chicken to chicken. In fact, it's even worse than it sounds because the chickens have been pre-selected, genetically modified to select for certain desirable traits like large breasts. And so there is no genetic variation among these chickens. And we're talking about thousands and thousands of them. So the virus keeps jumping from chicken to chicken, gets so powerful that at one point it is powerful enough to then infect a human being. And now it is super powerful. It is a super virus. So my fear about a pandemic that comes out of factory farming is that it will be as easily spread as COVID, but much more lethal. And that is the nightmare scenario. And the reason this is likely is because 99% of the meat we eat around the world is now factory farmed in the developed world, which by which I include very much include countries like the United Arab Emirates. So any place where you, every rich country is increasingly relying on factory farming. Organic farming is a tiny elite fad. The real source of meat is this terribly unsanitary situation that is almost designed to produce viruses.
So let's look at the response to the pandemic and the lessons we've learned about that. I know you've contrasted a few places. You contrast the country where you live, the United States, with, for example, Taiwan or Germany. Some of the stats I've seen you compare the death rate in New York versus Taiwan, which have similar populations. In very simple terms, how would you summarize those differences?
So Taiwan really gets the gold medal. 24 million people right next to China, got millions of tourists from China, and they have had 7 COVID deaths. New York State, which has about 19 million people, so fewer people, has had 34,000 deaths. And Taiwan is sort of off the chart. Taiwan, Singapore are really extraordinary. But around the world, you've seen many governments that have been able to do pretty well. And what's interesting is that it's not all a story of democracies doing well or dictatorships doing well. It's a mix. Singapore is often called authoritarian. Taiwan is very democratic. The United Arab Emirates, by the way, in particular, Dubai, does very well. And nobody would call Dubai a democracy, right? So what I argue in that lesson is that it's not really the old distinctions are less important, democracy versus dictatorship, big government versus small government. It's really the quality of government, not the quantity of government. Taiwan, for example, spends much less on healthcare than the United States. I think the United States, by some measures, spends 3 times as much per capita as Taiwan does. So it's not how much you spend, it's not the regime type, it's do you have a competent government? Do you trust in it? Are the experts given the independence and the funding they need to do what they need to do? And is there a certain degree of social trust? And I think, you know, frankly, the UAE example is quite striking because what the government of the UAE was able to do is very quickly do the central thing you need to do, which is massive rapid testing with results that arrive early, and then some kind of contact tracing that is enforced reasonably well. If you look at every successful case, that is the formula. So it's not that difficult to explain. It just turns out to be very difficult to implement.
Let's talk, if we can, for a moment about a country you know well, the country you were born in, India, the massive population here in the UAE. How would you rate India's response to this? And what would be the post-pandemic lesson for a country like India?
It's a great question. Unfortunately, India does not score very well on this. India has always been this strange paradox of a very vibrant, dynamic society with a highly dysfunctional state. That is why there are so many Indians in Dubai. In fact, Indians like to joke that the most successful Indian city in the world is Dubai, because there are so many Indians and many of them in fairly prominent positions.
I'm married to one of them, Fareed. My wife is Indian.
Well, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. I think that's a picture. That's a real picture of the UAE. Look, the problem in India is that you have never really prized government efficiency. What you have prized is government authority, government control. And as a result of that, the government tends not to perform well in these circumstances. Remember the terrorist attack that hit Mumbai, when they took over the train station and that. And it, for those of us who looked at the videos, it was frightening, but fairly familiar, which is that the police just ran away because the idea that the police was actually meant to function like a police struck them as bizarre. I mean, they fled faster than the civilians did. So it's a sign of just the Indian state has never performed well. COVID has highlighted that. So to begin with, they shouldn't have done a lockdown. In a country as poor as India, the cure becomes worse than the disease. The number of Indian children who have died of malnutrition as a result of the lockdown far exceeds the number who have died from COVID. And that's just children, not to mention all the adults who've died from, you know, typhoid, dysentery, all the kinds of associated diseases that come from literally a cessation of economic activity. And, you know, in a country where still 400 to 500 million people live on less than $2 a day. So if they're not working that day, they don't eat that day. So to begin with, the lockdown was a bad idea. Then it was terribly enforced, by which I mean, and you will be familiar with this, if you visited India, massively overly enforced. So everyone's scared. The police thinks that they have this strange authority. For the first several days, all grocery stores shut down and all pharmacies shut down because they thought, well, it's a lockdown. Everything is closed. And then people had to explain, no. You do want people to eat. You do want people to have access to medicines. So the lockdown has been enforced much more brutally than it needs to be. And finally, back to the point we were talking about, there isn't good testing and tracing. The lockdown, even if it is necessary, is only meant to buy you time to put in place a system of testing and tracing, because that is really the only way you can solve this. And so India has, I have to hate to say it, failed on both those fronts. And then finally, India doesn't have the money to do much economically. So yeah, I wouldn't fault them that much. But when you're a poor country, there isn't an easy, you know, the United States can spend, by the end of this, the United States will spend $5 trillion in the next year, you know, if you count the first stimulus and what will be the second and third ones. Well, India can't do that. It can't print money. It can't borrow money ad infinitum. So unfortunately, it's a case of more of failure than success.
A couple of final questions, if I may. I couldn't have you on the line without talking about international policy and foreign affairs and potentially a new world order. And you talk about this a little bit in the introduction to the book. In simple terms, what is the world order today, and how might this create a new world order in the way that the Second World War or the end of the Cold War created new world orders?
It's a good analogy. I think the pandemic is accelerating changes that were already taking place. So I don't think that it transforms the world into something completely different, but we were already approaching a world in which clearly there were two countries that were in a league of their own, the United States and China. And I think what the pandemic is going to do is accelerate that reality. So the United States is number one on almost every measure. But most people would be surprised to learn that it's not just that China is the second largest economy in the world, but it is larger than the next four economies put together. In other words, you take Japan, Germany, and Britain, put them all together, and China is still larger than that. It is the second largest military by defense spending in the world, and again, larger than the next four put together. And this is a big shift. 15 years ago, the Russian military was four times larger than the Chinese military. Now the Chinese military is considerably larger than the Russian military. So we're in a new world where you have these two peer competitors, United States clearly more powerful, but you know, the United States was also clearly more powerful than the Soviet Union. It didn't change the reality that you had a duopoly, a bipolar world. And I suspect that what we are going to be navigating for the next 30 or 40 years are the contours of that bipolarity. It'll look very different from the one between the Soviet Union and the United States. Largely because we are living in a much more interdependent world. We're living in a world of many other powers, many of which are quite active. You know, so I think that no one system ever resembles the past completely. To give you one sense of the difference, at their peak during the Cold War, the United States and the Soviet Union did $2 billion of trade one year. That was the peak year of U.S.-Soviet trade. The United States and China do $2 billion of trade every day. So it's a much messier kind of bipolarity, but bipolarity nonetheless.
Very quickly, we have an election in 2 weeks' time. Leaving aside the bipartisanship, for someone who's listening to this, they're driving from Sharjah to Abu Dhabi, they're listening to Fareed talk about the election in 2 weeks' time. What's the one thing that people living in a country like the UAE need to think about in terms of this election? Why does it matter to them?
you couldn't have a greater difference in the worldviews of the two candidates. In fact, they probably disagree and differ most on foreign policy of compared with almost every other issue. Trump really is a rejection of 75 years of American foreign policy. Ever since Franklin Roosevelt, there has been an idea that the United States needed to be deeply engaged in the world, help create an architecture of peace and openness and a rule-based international order that has provided for general peace and prosperity and a marked difference from the preceding 75 years, that is the 75 years before World War II. That idea, that philosophy was bought into by every president, Democrat or Republican, since Franklin Roosevelt. Trump marks a break with that. Trump really believes almost the opposite. Trump believes that that whole system and that architecture has been one in which other countries have been able to prosper. The United States has paid the bills. It has been a sucker's game for the United States. It has been robbed blind. And that his task is really to essentially undermine those arrangements and that structure so that the United States can flourish. I happen to think it's a completely upside down view of the world. I mean, it is worth noting that in that 75 years, the United States has remained the most powerful country in the world. Its GDP has, I think, gone up 40-fold. It has maintained general peace in the world. So it doesn't seem like we've done so badly, but Trump very much believes in an isolationist America, a disengaged America, an America that has a much more inward-looking and unilateral worldview. And Biden believes in a more traditional, engaged, internationalist America. So for anyone around the world who wants to see an America that is engaged, whether it's on security issues, whether it's on humanitarian issues, I think, you know, the choice becomes clear. If you look at something like COVID, this is the first public health emergency, global public health emergency, since the founding of the WHO, which of course the United States did, that the United States is AWOL, is absent. And that is by design. Trump's action in this great public health emergency, the first pandemic in 100 years, was to withdraw the United States from the WHO, the World Health Organization. I think that says it all.
Last question. Your book is behind you on your bookshelf, 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World. Leave me, Fareed, if you will, leave us with a note of optimism. What makes you most optimistic for the world, the post-pandemic world?
I think one learns from failure. You know, you talk to any businessman, you talk to venture capitalists in Silicon Valley, and they will say the people make changes only when things go wrong, when there's dislocation, when there's crisis. So I believe that this crisis really has mobilized the world. We've all been affected by it, right? This is a crisis almost unique. Unlike 9/11, unlike the global financial crisis, this one has really affected almost every human being in the world. And that is a powerful tonic and a powerful fuel for change. Now, we have to make it happen. You know, these things don't happen automatically, but I'm very optimistic that people recognize that this is a moment to change. And they have already had their lives dislocated so much that in a sense, making those changes become easier and more palatable. We just need the right leadership. And in many places, we do have the right leadership, just not in my country right now.
That's the voice of Fareed Zakaria, CNN anchor and author of the new book, 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.